Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome. We're delighted to have you here. I said to Admiral Greenert, I said, I'm shocked, you know, here the day after Halloween to have a crowd out at 8:30 in the morning. This is unusual. So it must be the submarine force that brings it out the best in everybody, I guess, you know. We're delighted that you're all here, and thank you for coming. And I want to say special thanks to our friends at Rolls-Royce that make it possible for us to do this. I've had the privilege of working with Admiral Greenert now for a couple of years, and a remarkable leader, and it's a very important time to have someone with his background and approach, and everybody welcomes him in the building and here in Washington, so we're delighted he's here. Maren Leet's going to do the formal introduction. I just wanted to say hello to everybody and tell you thank you for coming. Maren, why don't you do the real introduction?
Good morning, everyone. Thanks. Let me add my thanks for coming this morning. It is my honor to introduce our guest, Vice Admiral Jonathan Greenert. He's the Vice Chief of Naval Operations and has a very distinguished career, starting with graduation at the Naval Academy and then commanding at every level, to include the USS Honolulu, where he was the recipient of the Vice Admiral Studeman Inspirational Leadership Award. He also commanded Submarine Squadron 11, was the commander of Naval Forces Marianas, the commander of U.S. 7th Fleet, and commander of U.S. Fleet Forces Command. Again, we're honored to have him here this morning to talk about how the Navy is going about dealing with the efficiencies drill. So, over to you.
Thank you, Maren. Appreciate it. All right. Should be fun here. See if I don't, make sure I don't get any feedback here since I'm already mic'd up. Dr. Hamry, thank you for thank you very much. Where's Dr. Hamry? Oh, thank you very much for inviting me. And Dr. Lee, thanks a lot. I'm really honored to be here. Y'all are crazy. It's Halloween. Most of y'all are trick-or-treating. I hope y'all had a good weekend. Mine was pretty awful, if I might add, because I'm kind of a sports enthusiast in my own way. Graduate of the Naval Academy. My wife's a graduate of Michigan. Steeler fan. Skin fan. Okay? And I was pulling for the Rangers. So how are we doing so far, huh? You like that, huh? Sounds good, yeah. So, but it's been a good month, October, overall. It was our birthday on the 13th, and I got to speak frequently, actually. It was not bad. Some folks invited me back. And, you know, you get out there, you see the fleet, and you look in the eyes of the officers, and it sort of brings me back to a fable. It's almost as good as Aesop's fable. And somehow, an admiral, a Navy lieutenant, and a seaman, Navy seaman, got caught behind enemy lines. And they said, well, we're going to execute all of you, but you get one last wish. Some of you may have heard this, but I still get a kick out of it. So they say, seaman, you're first. And he said, well, I'd like a steak dinner, mashed potatoes, beans, and I want apple pie a la mode for dessert, and give me the finest Merlot. And he said, granted, good for you. And he said, admiral, what do you want? So the admiral said, well, if this is it, I'd like to give one last speech to all of my colleagues out there and my force out there. And they said, okay, granted. Lieutenant, what do you want? Said, just execute me before the admiral gets his wish, will you? So, today maybe we can have a little conversation, and I'll try not to execute you or make you feel like that. Listen, I'll lay out a little bit on the operational and fiscal environment, talk about what we view as really a mandate and where we need to go and our process and our commitment to that, and be happy to take some questions. But Navy's busy. Your Navy is busy today, as busy as it has been, and we think it'll be the same in the future. As of Friday, we have 288 what we call battle force ships, 160 of them underway, 114 of them were deployed. And that's 46,000 sailors out there afloat. But there's also 15,000 sailors ashore in the Central Command. And they're doing Operation New Dawn, supporting that, still Operation Enduring Freedom, doing about a third to a half of the close air support over there. Ballistic missile defense in three theaters, counter-piracy, humanitarian assistance in Pakistan, still going on, and in the Philippines, and we have a deployment down in the Southern Command. We have three strike groups underway, two in the Central Command, the Lincoln and the Truman, and we have one in the Western Pacific, of course. We have four amphibious ready groups underway right now, two in the Central Command and one in the Western Pacific and one in the Southern Command right now deployed. And we have three carrier strike groups and three amphibious ready groups getting ready to deploy. So we've got a lot of people out and about today. And looking at our planning scenarios for how the future might propose itself to be, it looks like that's not going to change that much, that demand for being forward and out and about. But our fiscal situation is different, and the SecDef was pretty straight up when he talked to us about this concept, and he said, look, this is not about cutting the budget as it stands now. This is a unique opportunity. We looked at it that way, in that when we work on these efficiencies, we get to keep the savings and reinvest them. And we have an opportunity, in my view, that we can shed some overhead that, frankly, is something that we should and we have been taking a look at for some time. Our DoD budget has been inevitably, it will be inevitably, it has been pressurized, and it's probably, there's some likelihood it will reduce. It's a function of the economic crisis that we're in, and a flattened base budget, and the service in our national debt. And we learned a lesson. We watched it in the Cold War. It happened. It's a lesson learned. If you have a poor economy, you can't be a very good world power. The Soviets learned that the hard way. Now, some of you have seen before some of the historical sine waves. Some of you study that. 31% cut after Vietnam, 36% cut through various and sundry means after the Cold War. We had reinventing government. We had what we did, which was recapitalization. We retired a lot of squadrons and ships to recapitalize in the mid-90s, and, of course, we had BRACs. But the status quo, in our view, is probably untenable, the budgetary status quo. There is an imperative for change, we think, and we really think we need headquarters support in order to make the changes in the overhead that we think are right. The Secretary of Defense asked us to institute a culture of savings and restraint, but I tell you, I think it's not just an attitude that we have to have here at headquarters. That's pretty cool. That's good. But if we don't get this inculcated out into the fields and out into the fleet, then it's unlikely we'll be as successful as we need to be. This is just not just a headquarters issue. We have got to get to the right people. Secretary of Defense's message to us was, I want you to be bold and aggressive. I want to do this quickly and not incrementally. We usually do things incrementally. So that's a kind of a different kind of a challenge for us. He said, I want some fundamental restructuring. I want to focus on resources where they belong. Put the resources where they belong. Look at organizational consolidation to reduce your layers in the chain of command. And he wants us to find better and streamlined ways of doing business. So that's kind of his mandate to us. That's how he laid that out. I talk a little bit about our imperative, how we view it, and our process. In other words, how we approach the efficiencies. We were issued a target, and there was an overall target, a fit-up target, and we got one by year. And we were also given tail-to-tooth objectives on how to do that. So one of the first things we needed to do, you go read the book, Leading Change. Many of you have read that book, studied it some way. I know if you're a naval flag officer anytime in the late 90s, you probably saw that book. Vern Clark was very, very good at pushing that to us. And it states pretty clearly, you've got to have a clear urgency and you've got to reach your people if you want to make change. So that was really the first thing we did. We sat down around the headquarters, at Navy headquarters, and said, hey, look at this. We've got this challenge. And I looked in all the deputy chiefs of naval operations' eyes and said, it looks like the N8's got a problem. And so we had to have the title of another book, which is A Powerful Conversation, that this is different, and we have got to think this through. Step two was defining our first principles and clarifying what we viewed maybe as tooth versus tail. And really the context we had to figure out is like, what is your overhead? What is tail today, and what do we view as overhead? Because, frankly, I mean, think about it, it's changed. Our bases aren't what they were 10 years ago. In other words, we don't view them as just tail. There is a lot of things directed on bases today. What we call, if you fly, you have an aviation operations center, which is where the sorties come out of, where you do your ATO, your air tasking order. We have a maritime operations center. Some may think, well, that's a headquarters in a building, so that must be tail. Hey, that's where we direct all our fleet operations. Trainers, ballistic missile defense planning is done remotely, and that's not tail. And cyber warriors, cyber, I mean, that's the real deal. Is that tail? Maintenance is not what it used to be. So I think you get the point. There are a lot of things we had to look at just in those areas to make sure we got the idea right and what are folks thinking through. So we had to distinguish overhead from really critical enablers and determine what's delivering the effect as we think this through. Now, this is not rocket science. One would hope as in the routine of our operations and our programming and doing business, we had figured this out. But it's something we had to think through, and we had to have a conversation, and those who are keeping track of, you know, kind of the scorecard on what we're doing. It's been a complex thing. It's evolving. Our database, our fiscal database, is not lined up to say, this is tooth, this is tail. And folks have gone out and said, well, let's put a code on it, an FIC, which I think means functional identification code. I'm not sure exactly what it means, but you're trying to tag what this is and what that is. It doesn't work that way. Things are very well are so integrated, so I don't want to say it doesn't work. It's not perfect. It'll only give you a kind of a concept and trends. So it is complex and is evolving. And then there's contractors. And not all contractors are bad. It's sort of like cholesterol. You got your HDLs, you got your LDLs. And then contractors, a lot of them are turning wrenches and getting airplanes and ships and that ready. They are operating right with us. They're in the cyber domain. And then you've got support, which is something we have to think about before. So we had to fundamentally look at all of that. So we took an assessment of our infrastructure and approached it somewhat deliberately. We used some of our friends from the Center for Naval Analysis, some of our friends down at OSD. If you know Sam Kleinman, he's down there. Chatted with those guys. And, you know, the general sense was, hey, if you want to look at your overhead, what has been kind of tried and true through the years is, number one, look at the balance of your infrastructure and your force level. Is it making sense in your intra base? Within your base, do you have your buildings where they should be? Do you have your people where they should be for where your ships and your aircraft are? Interbase, why do you have all of the type model series aircraft like this? Why do you have your ships like that based on where your training is, based on where your maintenance is? So you have to have the right balance of your infrastructure and your force level. Two, you got to consolidate and reduce excess and remove duplication. Now that sounds like, well, how hard is that? Well, it is hard if you aren't looking at it all the time and you aren't watching it closely. You can get out of whack on that. Three, improve your internal processes. Lean out. Lean Six Sigma. Look at these kind of things. Look at, you know, performance-based logistics. Look at your inventory. Do you still need all that stuff? When was the last time you looked at all of that? Business process engineering is that. Four, you got to look at competition. Right? There is a background of competing where we did foster real savings. And we went into this stuff in the 90s. It worked. We had at one time the idea to take about 50,000 positions out in our facilities, on our bases, and compete them. And we started down that road, and then the decade changed over. We got into 9/11, and a lot of things changed. And there was, frankly, a lot of resistance in and around the unions, and things just kind of got hard. And so we kind of moved away from that. So, yeah, we ought to look at that again. Five, we need to enable the self-adjusting of infrastructure. And what that means, that's kind of whatever speak for those people who are receiving the essence of the infrastructure and the support and the overhead ought to have a pretty major say in it. So our fleet commanders ought to have a pretty major say in the size and the capacity. What capabilities and what capacity do we need for maintenance, for logistics, and is it in the right place and in the training to enable them to have a say in it. And then lastly, after you look at all that, evaluate initiatives that might impact readiness. Look at your steaming, look at your flying, look at your what we call the fleet response plan, which is the basic means by which we build forces, organize them, train them, equip them, and make them ready for the combatant commanders. So we did all that. We took a look at that. And our focus of effort, if I could summarize it into a few things, I would say, one, we decided we wanted to buy smarter. How about that? Isn't that brilliant? But what it means is we looked at what requirements that we have out there are really affordable? What kind of technical risk level are we asking industry or we're asking our research labs to look after? And is this going to be affordable in the near term? Do we need to evolve more rather than have a revolution in some of the things that we're asking our people to do? Pete Corelli, when he did something similar, I think he called them portfolio reviews. We call them wholeness reviews. Call them whatever you want. They're an end-to-end look at what you're doing, what the capabilities are, and can you reach those in the near term, and is the technology really going to get you there sooner than later? We looked at focused R&D. Do our capability needs, as we see them out there, how are they aligning with what we're asking science and technology to do? And I'm not saying we took science and technology and said, all right, if you aren't connected to a capability, you're out. That's not what I mean. It's going back and looking and saying, are our future naval capabilities that you may produce kind of aligning with where we're going and with where we're being asked to go? We look to buy at more efficient rates, multi-year procurements, economic order quantity, terminate inefficient or ineffective programs. We're just not going to get there. You know, we've been trying to reach this. It isn't going to happen. We're going to have to terminate you. Sorry. We looked at programs that said, you know, we are almost at the buy rate. Why should we stretch this out? Would it make sense to buy this out and then maybe close the line down and maybe look for the next effect, the next capability that we may need in that area? Is that more effective? And pursue contract efficiencies. Contractor support, I mentioned before, administration, looking at that and looking for maybe fixed price contracts, something where it makes sense. We look to streamline the organizations. Talked about that earlier. We approached that more from a, do we have symmetry where we should have symmetry? Our numbered fleets, as they are laid out around the world, do they align with our naval component commanders properly, or do we have a large numbered fleet somewhere where we have a large naval combatant commander, naval component commander, and vice versa? So we look for symmetry across our organizations and duplication. We looked at non-core personnel policy. Again, contractors where we really may not need them, education, opportunities, privileges, which may be viewed as entitlements, and we say, what's the payback in that? Does it make sense? Can we afford to do that? And how does that balance? We looked at our operational profile. Does today's fleet response plan align with where we should be tomorrow and in 3 years and after current operations? And we looked at energy efficiencies. Our transportation, are we buying effectively or are we buying really big gas guzzling or leasing gas guzzling SUVs? Well, we were. Are we looking for fuel alternatives? We were not, so we're looking hard at that. Some of you already know that. We look to meter more where it makes sense so that we could see how are all of our peers, you know, how are they using power, energy, and to stabilize that and then to start ratcheting down on it. And alternate energy, as I mentioned before. Now, the way we look and see how we're going to do all this, you know, what we decide to do, how do you know how it's getting done? How do you synchronize and pull this together? What are the mechanisms and tools? We have a Navy Enterprise framework. We call it the Navy Enterprise. It has two major components. The Fleet Readiness Enterprise, which is really a gathering, some of you would call that the Board of Directors and say, yeah, that's probably about right. And what they are in the Fleet Readiness Enterprise, they are those folks that pull together the resources, people, money, and time being training resources, ship operations, aircraft operations, together to make sure that those readiness resources are put together in a proper sequence and for the proper goals. We have the Fleet Readiness Enterprise, and then we have in the headquarters in and around Washington predominantly the Provider Enterprise. And these are our systems commands, our engineering facilities, our acquisition offices. And basically, if you have to get a seat at the table at these two enterprises, you have to have money. You have to have what we call budget submitting office. And it's the idea is to sit down and synchronize those that deliver people, those that deliver contracts, look at your aviation technical, ship technical, and ashore technical people and meet to pull that together. That stakeholder forum, if you will, board of directorship, we've been at that for about 8 years now, and it's relatively mature. We've gotten some reasonable payback from it, and we find that it's a pretty good body to bring people together to help push us through this efficiency process that we're working. The objective is to collaborate, to share, enhance business best practices, understand cause and effect of relationships, and establish an accountability for output, underlying accountability. Who is willing to say, I'll take that one on, and I'll be accountable to that? And lastly, and mechanisms and tools, or secondarily mechanism and tools, I should say, we want to look at those things and those means to increase transparency, both of our total, really transparency, and our asset visibility. What do we have, and where is it? And do we need so much of it if we can know where it is and move it around more quickly? So the commitment in all this is really what's going to allow us to get it done. This is a new fiscal reality for most of our flags and most of our senior executive service. They've gone 15 years on supplemental appropriations. We've been on them since at least 95. That's as far back as I can remember when I was in and around programming and budgeting. Really, a lot of that was Bosnia-Herzegovina, but we've been on it. And we have really not had a lot of folks really needing to be accountable for the fiscal performance out there, because there's always been a supplemental sort of around the corner, and holding that in your mind is something that's been difficult. Total ownership cost, the end-to-end cost of a program, considering that, considering the training requirements that need to take place in a program, is something. It's all part of our program and our acquisition reviews that we have to inculcate in people, and they have to think in that manner. And we have to tell our leaders out there that they need to understand their portfolio execution. And again, that total ownership cost, they need to lean out what they have. They need to challenge the assumptions under which they're operating. Many just kind of taking things the way they are. It's the way they've been taught, like I said, in these last 15 years. We need to communicate clear and realistic output, what we really expect of those folks. And good leaders create reality. They determine the reality of those people that work for them, and then empower them to do that. And we need to continue that. We need to develop our strategies that are consistent with the fiscal environment. And what I like to say, as a budget guy from before, we need to look at our wake. Those of us that, if you go to sea, you steer a course, and there's a couple of things. You know, you steer a course on a gyro, doesn't matter what you're on. It says you're on course, 135, but is that magnetic course? So you got the influence of the magnetic field of the Earth. You got the arrow of the gyro. You got yourself. You got set. You got drift. You think you were headed at 135, and you're going over about 7, 10, 11 degrees that way. So the only way to really see if you're going where you want to go is to kind of keep looking back at your wake. And we've had a propensity to do what I kind of call open circuit budgeting, open loop budgeting, deliver the budget, get it back, send the money out to the budget submitting offices, and move on to the next budget and say, have a nice day, I hope everything goes well. They come back and say, in about 3 months, Armageddon is about to set in, and we say, okay, we'll keep an eye on it. And then September the 30th, there's no Armageddon. So how did that happen? And going back and looking through all that is something we need to look at much more closely. How is it we've been able to get through these years, and where are the best practices? So it's different this time. We firmly believe that. The chief has been very clear on that. We are the smallest Navy since 1916. Yet we have a strategy of engagement that's going to require presence. As I said before, we don't see a dramatic change after OEF and Operation New Dawn. We have high-tech threats proliferating. The shipbuilding industrial base is smaller. We have to be more effective. We have to listen to each other better, because we have to partner in a way that makes sense. We have reduced our personnel over the last 7 years, that's about right, by about 15%, but our personnel accounts have rose 13%. So we didn't gather a great, a big shot in the arm of savings there. But the sailors we have remain the finest that we've ever had by any comparison. Lastly, future challenges. After OEF, our rotational deployment support will need to be reset. We'll have to figure out what will that deployment be in the future. Are we reset properly to continue to do that as necessary? There's don't see a peace dividend, if you will, for the Navy, and that we can tie up for a substantial amount of the fleet and take a deep breath and go back. The world just doesn't seem to look like that. We have to figure out how to migrate. First of all, I think we have to better define what is going to be operational contingency operations, OCO, and that's the operational term, so that we can determine how much of the OCO fund should be in the base, so that we understand what is a contingency of the future and what isn't by the rules that we currently have in OCO, and how do we determine those rules in the future. We've got to get manpower costs, if you will, under control. In other words, we've got to be comfortable with what we view we should pay for compensation and entitlements for our people. An O5 today gets paid about $22,000 more than they did 8 years ago, same O5, or an O5, same years. Okay, it is what it is. And so what kind of ramp is that? I don't know. What kind of ramp can we afford when we think through that? O&M costs, the cost to put an aircraft in the air for an hour, that's a metric we have, is currently untenable. We have to look at that. In my view, by the way, it's just not the old guys keeping them up there. It's some of the new guys. And what we have to look at is the why. I mean, we're exposing the what does it cost is kind of good. It's kind of nice. You need to know what it costs. But why does it cost that, and what are the engineering solutions to reconcile that, and what kind of simulations are available out there? Industry has a great deal of simulation stimulation, and have we leveraged that to its full capacity? We need to look at that. And lastly, I'd mention we need to ensure that our ships meet their expected service life. That is part and parcel of the foundation of our long-range ship inventory and our plan. And so we have to maintain them properly and smartly and operate them smartly and properly, and that includes manning them. Let me close and say I would like to underline, it's a pretty exciting time. I'm kind of grown up as a budget geek, so that's pretty exciting for me to see these changes. We've done this before. We can do it again. I'm convinced of it, so it's an opportunity. Looking at our excess infrastructure and our total force manpower and what is right for the combatant commander in a collaborative manner is necessary. So an open, collaborative, deliberate way ahead, to me, is the path to success. Thanks for listening. Be happy to take your questions.
For that great review of how you guys are thinking about this whole problem set. Let me take the prerogative of the semi-chair in the chair and ask the first question if I could. And
sure.
Then as the audience asks questions, if you could please be sure to identify yourself and wait for the microphone. Thank you. I wanted to ask about the fact that the Navy, in its past efforts over the last decade or so to find efficiencies in various ways, I think recently found that some of the efficiencies that they took led to some unexpected decrements in effectiveness. And so I was wondering if you have a different mindset, if this wake watching or more closed process will, you think, better situate you to kind of avoid some of those pitfalls as you're going through this drill,
right,
or how you're planning to address that.
I think the biggest example, the best example of that might be our manning. Our ships, and we took, I would say, without a more centralized approach, a more an enterprise approach, looked at adjusting the manning on our surface ships. We looked at what we call top six roll down, where we reduced the seniority on our ships, and that seemed to be a good idea. If you, in person, billet might be an E7, we'll say, well, we can make that an E6, E6, E5, and say, okay, that's good. Now, that assumes that everybody that is currently on the ship will be on the ship next year. But at the same time, we were looking at optimal manning, where we said, well, tell you what, if we put these new systems in, are they mature? I'm not sure we really figured that completely out before we put them in. Put a new system on, new monitoring, remote monitoring system. So then we reduced the manning a little bit on the ship. So now you're a little more junior, you're a little less manned, and you're depending on technology to deliver and to prove itself. And we didn't do that in, a collaborative enough manner. So that gets to the enterprise approach I talked before. That gets to getting everybody there and ensuring you understand better the cause and effect of the efficiency. It's critical, or we could have the situation, well, that example that you described before.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Do I pick, or do you pick?
What do you want to do?
Admiral, go ahead.
Eric McVaden. Admiral, you talked about reset. I always think about China, so I wonder to what degree we reset with respect to China and kind of turn the situation on its head. We have a lot of difficulties with them. I wonder how many of them we can put behind us, like Taiwan. I wonder to what degree we can make our energy demands a mutual need rather than a point of controversy. I wonder about Northeast Asia security arrangements. I wonder about things that some have forgotten about, like the Global Maritime Partnership. There are other opportunities for U.S. Navy, PLA Navy cooperation. I've been recently pointing to the hospital ship and its possibility as in a humanitarian disaster relief exercise, maybe making a habit of that sort of thing. What I'm talking about is really trying hard to make build some trust and confidence and make a partnership out of this. And I know the Chinese make it hard, and I say it is hard, but it's too important not for us to give it a real try. On the other hand, obviously we have to hedge. How's the NUCAS coming as something that we can throw at the Chinese if we need to?
So if I may, I'll get to NUCAS. That was your straight question. But you did, I think, say what's Global Maritime Partnership. You're a believer in that. I'd say it's alive and well in that our latest International Sea Power Symposium we hold in Newport, we had more chiefs of Navy attend and join all of the groups, if you will, the plenary sessions, more than we've ever had. Numbers, 95 out of the 105 in the world that our chief of the Navy showed up at the last time. We have a coalition task force in the Arabian Gulf that has been led by coalition partners, and we have rotated through two different coalition task forces there. Navies of South America are stepping up in a big way to cooperate together, not just individually. There's more multilateral there. So I think that's alive and well. Counterpiracy. In the CTF 151, they were not a formal member, but they operated with, in around, and the coalition, if you will, or the task force, I should say. So they were, a member of the, if you will, the neighborhood of nations. The military maritime consultative talks, MMCA, I think that's about right. Agreement, yes, agreement talks. But we're talking again. We just hosted them. PACOM is the we in this case, a few weeks ago. So that is back on the step. And to me, that is a very important leverage. It's got a great terms of agreement. It's got a great charter. And we have solved issues in the past through that. So we've got to continue to take advantage of that. And Admiral Willard is leading the campaign in that regard. That is the relationship with China in cooperation with Department of Defense staff. So how is NUCAS coming? She should fly in December. She is on a track to demonstrate flight, if you will, unmanned flight, you know, and the carrier component of that is on a track that next year we would be able to test that with a surrogate Hornet. And so that's coming together. Trust me, I'm kind of fixated on it. Of all things, a submarine are fixated on that because that, to me, is our window to unmanned carrier flight. And that is a future. Chief of Naval Operations, Secretary of the Navy view that as our future air wing will be that combination. To me, that's the window. We go through that, you know, that's the rabbit hole, Alice in Wonderland. You pick whatever you want, but we've got to get that done and get that done on time. Kevin? Kevin Green.
Thanks for being with us this morning, Admiral. You mentioned the balance between infrastructure and force levels. Really, two questions. One is, how's the joint basing process going? And second, is it time for another BRAC?
The joint basing process is going well in that we are taking bases and we are operating them in a joint manner. The Hawaii HICM, combination worked, just Pearl Harbor HICM, I should say, worked very well. Wasn't all that difficult in that you had two cultures living side by side with a chain link fence between them. And so it was very symbolic when the chain link fence went down and the gate went open. And the savings were amazing, right? There's the Boling Anacostia that is now underway. So we're finding that that we can do this. It's the matter, but it gets to then what? Okay, we've established that. Are the savings there? They're not there right now. And will they manifest? We'll see. But there's definitely a synergy in the cultural piece, and where people make out on that is really family support and things of that nature, sailor and airman support, a consistency across one or the other. If Pearl Harbor is loaded, lots of ships in and whatever, as you go to Hickam and then vice versa. And so the ability to do that from child care through Fleet Family Service Centers to I think what we call, we're going to call it warrior, but they changed it. I think it's military member service centers. That part has been okay. So I think the jury is still out overall. Is it time for another BRAC? I think time will determine that. It won't be a decision that we'll make, but the Secretary has asked us to look at bold initiatives and bring forward those things that we think are worthy of consideration. And when I say Secretary, I mean Secretary of Defense. Sir, did you, Matt, there was a green tie there, sir?
Yes, Admiral. Thank you, Steve Benson. The air-sea battle concept, how is that coming as it's being put together, and does it have a role in the bold approach to efficiencies and that the DOD is pursuing?
What I'll call the first increment of the air-sea battle is complete, and that is the results of the collaboration of the Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps team getting together to evaluate anti-access area denial, and really, rather than it being an anti thing, we'll just say what kind of joint operational access is necessary as we look in the future. And that's complete. They've put together a very good concept. It's classified right now, and so what we have to figure out now is that what elements should be unclassified and how do we distribute it. I would tell you there are three key parts of it, though. One is an institutional aspect of it, and that is what institutionally, policy-wise, diplomacy-wise, interagency-wise, is the proper approach to take in this joint operational access concept, looking around the world at different areas where we may be challenged. There's a conceptual piece, and that means looking at the capabilities that the air and sea, those that provide capabilities in the air and the sea, is there a duplicative nature here? Are we interoperable as we should be? Is there a gap that neither of us three provide that we need to look for in a material solution? And then there's the .MLP, MLPF, whatever, .MILP aspect of that needs to get done. Lastly, materiel, those things that you would expect. Hey, there's just clearly some things that need to be procured. There's not, and it could be a kinetic, it could be a non-kinetic aspect of that, from ISR, through a missile or a bomb. So those are the three key pieces. The first increment is done. It's classified. The folks are writing it. Now, when I say it's done, we're trying to do something a little different. Not just finish a project, throw together an amazing PowerPoint brief and never write it down so you could read it from cover to cover and understand the assumptions, the conclusions, and maybe the challenges and get perspective. So they're writing it now. Thank you. Matt, did you have a question?
Matt Moffitt, Boeing Company. Two-part question. You talk about total ownership cost, near and dear to my heart. Part of the solution to total ownership, from my perspective, is upfront investment for that long-term ownership piece. How are you going to go about doing that within the current organizational construct you have within the OPNAV staff? And then the second part is the OPNAV staff, since that construct kind of got us where we are today or got you where you are today, any thought about reorganizing in a more efficient and effective way to deal with the realities that you spoke to here? Thank you.
The way to deal with it, there's a formula and or a percentage that basically says if you work to change the requirement in the first 20% of the development, you all know better than I do probably because you live it, but you get my point on that. That early phase, and you have the, if you will, the powerful conversations you need to have, then you're much better off on the other end. We are doing this in a very deliberate way on SSBNX, looking very, very clearly, closely, I should say, at the requirements, and why are these the requirements, and what do they portend for future requirements? But to your question, the way to develop that is to make training a part, at least a key, a KSA, a key something attribute, system attribute. Okay, it's hard to make it a key performance parameter early on, which has its own term, if you will. So the point here, very early on, a key part of the program has to be its training, its maintenance, its logistics, and we've focused too much, which you lived, on just acquiring the thing. Build it and get it out. And we say, okay, where are we going to train on this thing? How are we going to do this? How are we going to do it? We've done too much of that. So putting that piece up front and making that a part of the milestone, making that a part of the services cost estimate. And again, we've been working that pretty deliberately on SSBNX most recently, where we have actually put cost as a, with an objective and a threshold on that, just like we do the other parameters. And we want to move training into that and have that conversation. Bring the fleet in sooner, and they say, I don't know how I'm going to operate this thing yet. And say, well, let me ask you this. Can it be nuclear powered or not? And what difference does that make? And then they say, oh, that makes a lot of difference. I mean, you could, where can you operate? And I say, all right, now we're talking. So we start getting the conversation like that done earlier. Reorganizing is going to be hard in its own right because of a perceived Goldwater Nichols, you know, impenetrable membrane between acquisition and requirements. But we are working on a couple of things. One, the who comes to the meetings, to the forum, you know, and we've been very judicious. It's great having Dave Archizel at Nav Air doing acquisition, who was a requirements guy. Sean Stackley understands it very well, the value of it. And so they've been very good and judicious in helping do that. Lastly, we're working on a program some call the hostage exchange. I don't know if I'd call it that, where we send requirements officers over to spend time at acquisition offices. If you've got a two-year, yeah, I know, what a thought, what a concept. But if you've got a two-year tour in the Pentagon, maybe 6 months over to PEO. And we've seen great payback already from really the anecdotal pieces of that, but we want to institutionalize that, and it's underway right now. Thanks for the question. Yes, sir, back.
Admiral, Rick Nucio, CSIS. I'm the Army fellow here. First, I want to say thank you for coming and tell you that I actually had a great sports weekend because I grew up in Detroit, so the Lions feasted on the Redskins this weekend and the Red Wings won. So, sir, my question specifically is about efficiencies, and the Air Force vice was here last week, and I kind of like to think I know what the Army's doing. And then listening to your comments here this morning, I'm encouraged by all the talk about efficiencies and things like that. But I'm wondering at what point in DOD do we not look at this whole idea of efficiencies from kind of a joint perspective and say, Army, you know, you develop, land power resources in terms of battery and fuel efficiency for wheeled vehicles. And Air Force, you know, you develop, you know, airframe efficiencies. I mean, what's your perspective on that from a senior DOD position of our efforts to work like that?
That's an incredibly important point. We will have that conversation in that it is in the longer-term schedule of to come down and talk about who provides the best aircraft depot maintenance. And they say, well, you know, and where is it? And have you leaned it out? And if we'd say, yeah, we're very happy with what we have in our capacity, and we're about to reduce our capacity. And we might say, well, why would we do that when, in fact, this is totally hypothetical, please, another service has aircraft, and they are just about ready to cancel a contract and renegotiate it, and it's going to be expensive. So you could, all right, so that's one. Fuel, you hit the nail on the head on that. We are working with Air Force on manned. Where do we base them? Why would we have Navy and Air Force unmanned? I mean, it's unmanned, for crying out loud. So that would be that piece. I'm sorry, would you repeat your second question?
I mean, at what point do you see the, from a DOD perspective?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, the second one would be the JROC. JROC's never seen a requirement it didn't like. Well, there's also a piece where as you bring something forward, you know, there is a program forward to get blessed to move on through your milestone. At what point do you sit down and say, tell me about the interoperability and talk to me about, if we talk about the total operational cost of this thing and talk a little bit more about its life cycle, we can see one heck of a lot more on the maintenance required and where that may be done and how. So what I'm telling you is that the JTIDS process is a better way, a way to do that as programs go through milestones to stop and make that an attribute for it to proceed on. That's a good way to do it, in my opinion.
On to that, in addition to the sort of interdependencies on the support side that we just discussed, General Chandler alluded to his view that there might be additional interdependencies forced out of, by the budget situation. Do you foresee any on the operational side?
Forced interdependency?
Will the budget environment create a situation where we not only have to have interdependencies on the support side, but also on the operational? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, I would hope so. I think clearly in the naval aspect, the the Marines are very clearly coming back to sea. That's their desire. So there'll be the synergy that they bring when they when we operate together at sea is something we'll look at. And a lot of that is the effects from the sea that they would bring. Air-sea battle would be a classic right there. I mean, the conceptual aspect of that is what do you deliver, Air Force, Marine, Navy, what do you deliver? Why do we need two of maybe a munition? It may be, like I said, an ISR, a piece of ISR or something. So this has been a good, I hate to call it an exercise. That implies it's not real. But it's been a good endeavor, air-sea battle, from that regard. Yes, sir.
Sir, George Nicholson, a consultant. You alluded to the Army's portfolio review and the Navy's equivalent being the wholeness review. General Cirelli has talked about they're going to be finishing up their aviation portfolio review probably by the end of the year. What's the status of the equivalent Navy wholeness review, and how's that going to impact future POMs?
The tactical air review will be it'll be next year. It'll be finished by next year. It's more incremental than that. We're looking at TACAIR integration. We're looking at TACAIR inventory, and then we'll look at future capability in TACAIR. Air-sea battle will inform that, so we sort of timed it a little more to make sure it's informed by that. So, but an ASW, what we call wholeness, we just completed electronic warfare. When I say just completed, that was about 6 weeks ago. This past week, we did information dominance. We did it on a submarine warfare about 3 weeks ago. And these are on a drumbeat, kind of aligned with the chief's interest. Frank?
Thank you, Admiral. Frank Finelli with Carlisle. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the efficiency objectives from a perspective of obligational authority versus outlays and whether that has an impact on your analysis. And then secondly, as you look at POM 1216, where are some of the underfunded tails that concern you that might eat into these efficiency initiatives?
I'd have a hard time. I don't think at this point we are mature enough in comparing obligation with outlays. But I would tell you that one of the things for sure, sort of related, is clean financials and being sure that we are auditable and that we, like I said before, we look in our wake and say, is that the course? How do we get on this course? Or how do we get on this track, which is where you are over the earth? And we're working with Bob Hale's office pretty closely. The Marine Corps is just about finishing their audit where they declared auditable. We are learning a tremendous amount. And the point in all this, if you talk to the fleet and go, you budget geeks, what's this all about? Say, well, I'll tell you what, pal, you're leaving money on the table because by 30 September you want to balance and you want to make sure all your obligations add up. And guess what? If you're 99% effective, that's pretty good. But our budget's about $120 billion. So what do you think of that? Could you use $1.2 billion? So you sort of clean financials, Frank, is what where I think we can look to that. Now, Asset visibility sort of plays into that, because if you know where all your assets are, you don't buy more than you need, and therefore you don't obligate for that. So it plays a little bit of hand in hand in that regard. Tails beyond 16, like what's just outside of that, is we have obviously SSBNX is beyond that, and really the next Trident, if you will, the Trident follow-on program is beyond that. So there's a shipbuilding aspect that goes beyond there that we need to look at. There's clearly just the personnel. Where do we want to go with personnel when you look at that? The numbers and the entitlements and the compensation. So that goes beyond the fit-up. That's, if you will, an enduring value proposition that you have out there. Reset and future fleet operations and to what level will go beyond the fit-up as we see current operations kind of having a metamorphosis toward stability. But and lastly, I'd say, and I don't know how big it is, but we have to look at our missiles, both us and the Air Force, and we're working together on that to look at the rocket motors. You know, there's a shelf life on rocket motors, and so we both have to sort that out. That's pretty much an interagency problem that we'll work at beyond the fit-up. One more? Okay, miss in the back. Can we wait to the mic? Because I'm sorry.
Okay. Andrea Shalal, ESA with Reuters. I've heard both Admiral Roughhead and General Schwartz, and recently Peter Chiarelli talk about multi-year procurements as being one way that you can kind of move toward capturing these efficiencies. And I wanted to ask you if you think that there's adequate, mechanisms in place to ensure that the savings that you think you're going to get, that you actually realize them. And to what extent will multi-year procurements play a role as you move forward into the next budget cycle and the sort of next POM? It seems like F-35 would be the biggest get to get. But are there others, and how much, how well do you think those agreements are actually scrutinized to see that you actually do capture that savings?
I can tell you in a manner that is auditable for myself that those are scrutinized and ensured to be captured. I can tell you that it is very closely scrutinized by the Department of Defense and by the Congress before they authorize you to go to a multi-year procurement means of purchase on an item, that you can prove that you can meet those savings by them, because the federal government clearly is obligating themselves to do this. Okay, so there's a very close scrutiny by the Department of Defense and by the Congress. That's before, right. Now, after, you have to report out the cost, and there's a consistent report like there is on all programs that what they cost, what you got, and your obligation and your execution process. So as you report all programs, obligation and execution, you would report that. But it has been proven, there is a track record of multi-year procurement being a valid and efficient way to purchase a mature commodity. And one of the big issues here, or one of the big elements of this, is understanding the maturity of the program.
Thank you so much, Admiral, for coming this morning. Really appreciate
you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Coming to be with us.